Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Graham Nystrom, your host. The Conversation is KMUN's live call-in show where we hear from you, members of the community, about topics that affect our lives. I've missed talking with you for the last few weeks. We've been running election coverage. I hope that you've been appreciating that and learning about the issues and becoming an informed voter. Very important. We advocate that everyone vote, everyone engage in our democracy. If you are unfamiliar with the Harbor's mission is to provide advocacy, prevention, and support while promoting self-determination and hope for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. My two guests are Terry Steenbergen and Jordan Okanowski. Jordan, I hope I'm saying your last name right, but I've got my guests on Zoom, which means that we can have calls today. And we hope to hear from you. 503-325-0010 is the number to call. Why don't you guys go ahead and unmute yourselves, and welcome to the show, Jordan and Terry.
Thank you.
Thanks, Graham.
So you can hear me okay, and I can hear you okay. So we're off to a good start.
Fantastic.
Great.
But I went over the mission of the Harbor, but I'd love to give you the opportunity to tell the listening audience a little bit more about the organization and what you do. Jordan or Terry, who wants to start off with that one?
Terry, you want to tackle that one?
Oh, sure. I thought you were going to do it, but I'm happy to. So the Harbor works with survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking to provide resources and advocacy. I guess basically what that means is anybody who feels like they're in an unsafe relationship, or maybe even just a weird relationship, or not really sure what's going on, is more than free to give us a call. Or we have a 24-hour crisis line where we you know, obviously answer 24 hours a day. And we are there to help folks with safety planning if they're in an unsafe relationship but are not quite ready to leave it yet. We're there to help folks leave if they want to. We can help with restraining orders, medical advocacy. We can just help people find the resources they need in order to sort of move on. And then, of course, our advocates are really amazing, compassionate humans who are there to also just listen if somebody needs somebody to talk to. Because the thing that we know about domestic violence and sexual assault is that it's, you know, something that people don't necessarily want to talk about. It's something that people also don't necessarily feel like other people will believe them. And we always believe survivors, and everything that anybody ever tells us is totally confidential and won't be shared with anybody. Unless specifically asked by the survivor.
Can I ask you a little bit about the role of an advocate? Are these folks employees, or are they volunteers, or a mixture of the two? How do you get involved as an advocate, and what is that role like for those people?
So advocates are, they're employees. We've had volunteer advocates in the past, but we don't at the moment just because it's a little tricky with the social distancing and sort of the way things are working right now. But the advocates, again, they go through, training, an Oregon domestic violence and sexual assault training, that, gives them advocate privilege. And so they then become qualified to, you know, provide those resources, do all that listening. And then also advocate privilege means that they, you know, again, legally cannot share information about survivors, not just the information about them, but even the fact that we are working with somebody. So it's a thing I bring up all the time because it's a point that I think makes people feel comfortable working with us.
And so in different times when it is easier to have volunteers, those volunteers go through the same exact training that a paid employee would?
Yeah, they would go through the same training. They would then, you know, shadow an advocate and spend time learning sort of how it all works and how to access the resources and get people what they need. They would just, you know, probably only volunteer once or twice a month rather than, you know, working every day.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear a little bit more about both of you, if that's okay. Terry, remind me how long you've been the executive director of the Harbor.
I've been here since March 1st of 2019, so a little over a year and a half.
And how's it going for you so far?
Things are good.
You came in at
things have been really good.
Yeah. Came in at an interesting time.
Yeah, things are good. I mean, I think it was like at that year mark when the pandemic started, at my year mark when the pandemic started, and we were really starting, you know, it's like that point where you start to really feel comfortable with your job is after about a year, I think.
Yeah.
So it's been like the last, you know, 6 to 8 months have been kind of a whirlwind, but I think things are good. We have a really great team. The advocates are amazing. And again, like I said, they're, you know, really compassionate. They do a lot of amazing work. And I mean, I think we've been really busy and things have been pretty hard for the last 6 to 8 months, you know, more so than usual. But I think we're doing a lot of really amazing work. People are reaching out and, you know, we're getting the word out that we're there. And then we've also been able to start some new projects, which we can talk about even during this pandemic. So
you mentioned that COVID has during the pandemic, you've seen a spike, you're saying, in calls and need for your services?
Yes, absolutely. I think everybody heard at the beginning of the pandemic is sort of this there was a wave of news about how domestic violence incidents and calls were going to go up. And it was actually interesting for us because we had about a month of just quietness, which was really kind of scary,
yeah.
A little creepy, because we know that, you know, the violence still happens. It's just that people weren't reaching out, right? Because probably they were stuck in the house or, you know, it was a different world for everybody. And so it's just hard to sort of navigate how to, you know, what to do in just this extreme crisis that everybody was facing. But, you know, starting in about May or June, things really started to pick up. And just to give you, an example, like in the beginning of the year, we would get about 100 to 120 phone calls a month on our crisis line. And then, you know, in August, September, we were closer to 200 calls a month. And now in the last few weeks, we've been taking over 60, almost 70 calls a week.
Wow.
So it's really heightened quite a bit.
And is your capacity able to handle it with your number of employees and...
We are, you know, we're stretched pretty thin. I think the advocates there, again, they're amazing and they do a lot of work and it's a hard day to get through, sometimes just because they're so busy. I mean, even working with one person who has been through, you know, a traumatic experience is a hard thing to do. You know, folks are working with multiple people a day who just need an enormous number of resources. That's the other thing. It's like, there's more people. And there's just more need also. So it's, you know, not just restraining orders. It's not just accessing some of the other resources. And then there's also this housing need that's something that we deal with a lot too.
And is your background in social services and what kind of, you know, what's your background like?
So I worked for... maybe too long in politics, actually. I used to work on ballot initiatives in Oregon and also in some other states around the country. So I've done a ton of ballot initiative work and then decided that I didn't want to do that anymore. So in 2011, I went back to school and I have a master's degree in public health with a focus on international health and gender-based violence. And before coming here, I spent some time in Central Africa working with survivors and families displaced by conflict. So that's my other experience. And then in Portland, I also volunteered with the Call to Safety, which was the crisis line there. So.
Well, Jordan, let's hear from you for just a little bit. Tell me about your role at the Harbor, how you got involved, how long you've been there, and what your background is.
Yeah. So I actually volunteered with the Harbor from 2014 to 2016 for about 2.5 years there. And just like really enjoyed it and actually had moved away from Astoria and had the grand plan of becoming a teacher and actually just got my master's in education earlier this year and my teaching license and was excited to start the fall working in a school and like having a great time. And the world had other plans.
Best laid plans, yeah.
Yeah. And so I kind of like sized up my options and saw a lot of hiring freezes and had moved back to Astoria with my partner. And I found a job opening for the Harbor. And I was like, you know, this isn't exactly teaching, but also I loved my organization or loved this organization in the time I volunteered with it. And I would really like to be in touch with it again. So I applied. I got hired around July. So I'm a bit more fresh in the organization, but I've just been really impressed so far with the culture here, with all my coworkers, everything. I've been really, really pleasantly surprised.
And sorry if I missed it, but what's your job title?
So I am the event coordinator, which is maybe not too relevant right now, but I'm also an advocate as well. And so that's kind of the primary work I've been doing. And then I've also been helping out with Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
How many advocates total are on staff?
There's 8 full-time advocates. And then we have 12 staff, so we have a little bit of, we have some backup available when needed.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about it sounds like the first way to get in touch with you is on the phone. The first and best way to reach out to the Harbor is over the phone. Do you want to give that number out just in case folks have a pencil and want to have this handy?
Yeah, the number is 503-325-3426.
And tell me a little bit about the measures you take with confidentiality. I assume that's one of the most important pieces of this.
So Terry had mentioned essentially advocate privilege, which is kind of a similar notion to like lawyer-client confidentiality, doctor-patient sort of thing. We have legal requirements where we have to keep information confidential with our clients. So even if like the police called us up and they wanted information, we still couldn't give it because we have that duty to our advocates. And this is part of VAWA, I believe the Violence Against Women's Act, that essentially states that we have to keep this information confidential. So that's our legal requirement to do so. But beyond that, just every part of our job focuses entirely on survivor safety, which essentially means that we work for them. We are what we consider to be survivor-centered advocates. And so we have their safety in mind first and foremost. So we're never trying to get legal charges against someone if the survivor says, no, don't do that. Because that could be a huge issue of safety for people too. We want to respect the needs of the survivors at all times. And a huge component of that is their confidentiality. So any calls that we get to the crisis line aren't going to be shared out to people in the community. They're going to be kept completely within our organization in the utmost confidence.
And so say someone makes first contact over the phone and they describe to you their situation. Do a lot of these result in taking additional steps to, like, I know that there are housing opportunities, like safe houses of sorts. Is that part of the services that you provide? And how often do those calls turn into a situation like that? Or, where does it go from the call?
Yeah, we do have a shelter space. Our resources are pretty limited right now because of COVID protocols. It's a difficulty that we're dealing with in other spaces. But we do have that. It kind of goes step by step. It's a very needs-based screening, and once again, based on the needs and desires of the client. We'll take what they're saying. We'll talk to them. We'll try to establish maybe a good time to call them back after talking as an organization. Another big thing for us as an organization is that phone lines aren't always safe. So we can't just call back at any time. A lot of times we need clients to call us back, or we really, really need to establish a safe phone number or a safe time when we can reach a client again, because once again, their safety is of the utmost importance to us. And from there, we just look at services, we look at needs. An interesting thing about this job is that there's no one blueprint. Everyone has completely different needs, and there's a lot of resources out there. So a lot of times it's We kind of, amongst our organization, have a little brain trust, and we're just trying to find the best support and best resources we have for the clients that and the calls that we get.
So you're kind of that initial touch point, and then you help connect to other other services that are not necessarily under your roof.
Yeah. And to do that, we'll also need to, once again, with confidentiality, to get any resources for anybody. If we're going to share any information, we have to get written consent from the survivor or the person that called, even to talk to someone's spouse, sibling, anything like that. Even if they came in with that person, we still, in order to reach out and talk to someone, we still need to get their written consent. It's called a release of information. So we're usually the first touch step and then touchstone for these people, and then just trying to get information and resources as best we can based on what their needs are.
I'm curious about the organization and how it is connected to any other similar organizations. Like, is there a framework for the kind of, for the harbor that's duplicated elsewhere? Or are you a standalone entity that has its own mission, its own, you're a nonprofit, right?
Do you mean other sexual assault domestic violence agencies? Is that?
Yeah, like if you were in another city, would there be another harbor, or would it be called something different and have a completely different, you know, set of protocols and things? Or is there sort of like a framework for this kind of service?
I think, yes, they do exist across the state. I can't remember the sort of number of folks out there. So there's a coalition that's called the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And I think it's about 50 similar organizations. And it depends on where you are. You know, rural communities like here, we do all of the stuff, right? We're the crisis line, and we have a shelter, and we provide people with resources, and we sort of like cover all of the bases. And somewhere like Portland, there'll be like, you know, different entities. Like there's a crisis line, and then there are different shelters, and then there are people who provide other services. So that, you know, in like a bigger place, you'll see that the organizations are just structured differently. And in some of the rural places. But I mean, basically, you know, and it's up to each organization to sort of develop how they want to, but we're all basically the same. And all of the organizations do follow the Violence Against Women Act guidelines as well. So it's all, you know, it's pretty standard, I guess, across the board.
If you're just joining us, this is The Conversation on KMUN, and today's guests are from The Harbor in Astoria, whose mission is to provide advocacy, prevention, and support while promoting self-determination and hope for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. My guests are Terry and Jordan. Do you want to talk a little bit about Domestic Violence Awareness Month?
Yeah. So Domestic Violence Awareness Month is the project we've been working on right now, which is for the month of October. It started in 1981, first observed by the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And essentially, we're just trying to get a higher profile to the needs of survivors and to our services around the community right now. We're just trying to essentially just reach out to more people. The first project we did this month was the Purple Light Night, where we've been giving out these purple light bulbs to businesses downtown, as well as flyers, and having them put them in their windows. And with these flyers, it just kind of states like who we are, that this business is another business in Astoria that's taking a stand against domestic violence and also is willing to stand up for the rights of survivors. And with this plan, we were just hoping to essentially turn the entire neighborhood purple at night, and that way just show that we are, as a community, a safe harbor for survivors of domestic violence. And with that, too, we gave out pamphlets just talking about ways that people in our community who might not be as knowledgeable on these matters can support survivors of domestic violence in their lives. Things you can do if someone comes forward to you, things such as that. Because I think just... I know before I got involved with the Harbor, a lot of this, I just viewed domestic violence work as being just kind of scary, intimidating, and something that I think was easier to avoid than to get involved with. And I think a big part of this as well is just showing people that it's not necessarily super devastating all the time to make a difference in the lives of survivors, that you can do it and find the validation in it and the positivity. And so we're just trying to reach out and show that to people around here and be here for our survivors.
So the purple lights in the windows downtown was something that you started this month. Have you gotten some buy-in, and is it starting to look pretty purple down there? I guess I haven't drove downtown at night lately.
Yeah, I've been super impressed. We've had 4 advocates so far just go around at different days to different businesses. And I think maybe we've had 3 businesses say no thank you. And even one of those still gave us a donation. So yeah, it's been really successful. We've been going all around. We've talked to different organizations around South County as well too. It's been super positive. And it's always really validating to hear the community has our back.
So is there anything else you're doing to celebrate, or not celebrate, it's a bad word, but to increase awareness during Domestic Violence Awareness Month?
Yeah. So we've made a series of public service announcements that I'm hoping to get out on the radio here soon. Some of our advocates have been doubling as voice actors, which has been fun.
Cool.
And they are inspired by a public service campaign by the National Domestic Violence Hotline that is centered around interviews with people who essentially are abusers, just to show, I think like a lot of times we have this notion of what a domestic abuser looks like, and we think of someone who's just an outwardly monstrous, angry all the time sort of person. And these are just interviews with people showing what they value in a relationship essentially, and what they value about their partner, and just showing that even the most normal seeming people sometimes can have very unhealthy ideas of how relationships work. Because it's been an issue before with us where we've had, we've had clients before who haven't necessarily believed that they're in an abusive situation because there's never actually been a punch, you know? I think we need to redefine our views of what a healthy and an unhealthy relationship looks like. And that's what this public service campaign will hopefully do.
Not to put you on the spot, but can you give some examples?
So a lot of these revolve around concepts of power and control in relationships and control dynamics. I think a lot of times people associate domestic violence as always being about physical violence, hitting, putting down, things like that. But there's a very predominant theory of belief in domestic violence work that's just a symptom of a need for very intense power and control from abusers to their partners. And so all of these just kind of focus on relationship situations where there is a completely one-sided power dynamic that is being oppressively enforced. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I got it.
Yeah. I can play them for you. I'd love to pass them on to KMUN at some point in time too.
So. Yeah. Let's be in touch after the show about it. It sounds like you maybe had some statistics that you wanted to share, on both Oregon's statistics and national statistics on domestic violence.
Sure. I can be the fun statistics person. I think the thing that, we just want people to understand is that domestic violence and sexual assault are actually extremely prevalent, and it is very likely that you know somebody that is experiencing violence in a relationship. Not to be doomsday, but nationally, what we see is 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men have actually experienced some sort of physical violence from an intimate partner. And that's physical violence. And as Jordan was saying, that there are many forms of violence. You know, there can be emotional or psychological violence, financial violence. So those statistics are, even a little bit different. Intimate partner violence actually accounts for about 15% of all crimes that are committed, which I think is pretty staggering. So that's nationally. And then here in Oregon, recently, it was discovered that about 1 million women and girls have actually experienced some sort of sexual or domestic violence in their lives. And that's actually more than half of the female population of the state of Oregon. So that's even higher than what the national statistics are telling us. So I think that's pretty huge. The other thing is that we're still really starting to do a lot more outreach with youth and some prevention programming. Because I think one of the things that people also don't realize is that there's an enormous amount of violence happening in the teen population. both, you know, physical violence or intimidation or sexual violence. And so we see that about one in three teens is actually a victim of violence from an intimate partner, which is a pretty huge number. I think interviewed about 80% of parents actually don't believe that there are, that kind of thing is happening at all with their kids. So it's pretty staggering to know that, that a third of all teens are experiencing some form of violence from a close partner. And about two thirds of those kids are not actually sharing that with anybody because they just don't feel comfortable reaching out. They may not understand that they're in an unhealthy relationship. And then there's just not a ton of resources available for kids around violence, which we are hoping to change locally.
So we have a call coming in. And I'd like to see if this caller is calling to ask you a question. Hi, you're on the air. Did you have a question for Terry or Jordan?
No, I didn't actually have a question, but I do have a comment to make.
Please do.
And I don't usually call on these shows, but this one today just hit me because I have an ex-husband who seems to be a very nice guy, and he makes comments to me that make me try to change my mind about situations. And I just want to say that the thing about abuse and comments is that he'll say something to me that'll just instantly strike me and just, I get on my bad side, you know, and like I want to be defensive. And I just want to say that if I just told him that's an abusive remark, he's never been physical to me or anything like that ever in my entire life with him, that we go back 35 years, and I still deal with him. But if I just told him that's an abusive remark that you've just made to me, that would stop him in his tracks and make him realize what he's actually doing to the people around him, his family. And so that's all I have to say is that thank you, because that gives me some power instead of getting triggered and angry, that I can just say that's an abusive remark right there. So thank you for that.
That's a really powerful comment. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thank you very, very much. I appreciate you letting me voice my opinion on that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And thanks so much for sharing your story.
Mm-hmm. Do either of you have a response to that of how folks who are experiencing violence at home can take steps before it escalates or before it gets to the point where they need to call? I mean, do you see much of that happening? Or you mentioned prevention programs with teens and stuff. Like, what kind of education happens around self-assertion like that?
Well, I have answers to two parts of that. but I think right. You know, we know that domestic violence is centered in power and control. And a lot of that is centered in sort of these dynamics of power and oppression that we see, you know, socially. And so it is possible that if somebody is making abusive remarks that they don't know that they're doing it, and that if you pointed it out, they'd be like, well, I didn't realize that, you know, that's what it was. Because sometimes when you hold power, you don't realize it. And I think, you know, often that's not the case, but I think sometimes it is. And so I do like, thank, you know, again, thank you to the caller for sharing that story, because it is also, you know, it's also not necessarily easy to tell that it's happening. Like you can like feel it inside that like it's not quite right, or you don't feel great about what somebody just said to you, but you don't necessarily think that you know, that it's abusive or that, you know, there's something you can do about it. So I think, yeah, I mean, you can say something. I think the other thing is that you don't, you know, calling us doesn't mean you're at the end of your rope, right? It's like you can call us at any point and find out, like, sort of if you know, sort of what the dynamic is and how to deal with that. Like, you know, we do have an emergency shelter, but that's such a small piece of what we actually do. We do, like, really work with folks, you know, who are way before that point. To just talk about like what, you know, healthy relationships do in fact look like and how they can maybe work with our partner to make it more comfortable, you know, if they haven't gotten to that point or if it's not that serious. So I think, so that's another thing just is that, you know, people can call us even if they're not like, you know, running out the door. And I think that's true in a lot of cases. That's not where most people are at. And then the other part of your question was about prevention. And I think, yeah, so we actually just a couple of months ago launched a prevention program that, you know, we're trying to get off the ground during a pandemic, which is, you know, maybe not the easiest thing we've ever done, but it does start early. What we do know is that most people who experience violence experience it before they turn 18. And that if you have experienced violence before you turn 18, you're much more likely to then experience it again later in life. And so just really starting early with sort of teaching folks what healthy relationships look like. I mean, I would bet that most people, you know, adults, like are have some sort of unhealthy thing happening in a relationship, right? That's it's like, you know, nobody ever teaches us how to have relationships. So sort of getting in early to teach what healthy relationships look like. And then also just getting in early to talk about sort of, you know, mutual respect and how we don't have, you know, power over other people and, you know, talking about oppression and talking about what power and control looks like and really, you know, talking to youth about, you know, what it all means and how it all looks and how, you know, we need to be treating each other. And so that's, you know, that's our prevention program is going to be working with youth in schools. We also, you know, we'll be doing some work with sort of not youth also, but teaching healthy relationships and what those dynamics actually do look like in real life. And also, you know, sharing with people what abuse looks like, you know, like if your partner texts you 100 times a day to find out where you are, that's weird. It's not. You know, it's not comfortable. It's not that they cared so much about you. It's because they're trying to control what you're doing. Yeah. And that, you know, that's just an example. But I think that's something that people don't necessarily, you know, see. It makes you feel a little uncomfortable, but, you know, but it's a romantic uncomfortable, right? Like, no, it's not actually. It's just creepy.
So bottom of the hour here, about halfway through the show, talking with Terry and Jordan from The Harbor. And discussing Domestic Violence Awareness Month, I would here's a request for you. I am in ninth grade. I've been dating my first girlfriend for a week, and you come and do a presentation at my middle school or high school. Tell me what a healthy relationship looks like. What do you tell those kids?
You want to take this one, Sarah?
Go for it, Jordan.
I would say a good place to start is just with listening to each other and listening to each other's needs and also respecting each other's boundaries. Yeah, I think one of the first things I think we should be talking to kids about from a young age is consent and things like that. I think we talk about a lot of things related to that, but kind of dance around that one topic. I think just having that knowledge of consent, and also, as Terry said earlier too, that we don't control another person's body, we don't control what another person does, but listening to their needs and their boundaries and helping set up those boundaries is a really good first step. Terry, do you want to piggyback on that at all?
Well, you know, what's interesting though is as a ninth grader, I'm not sure I know what my needs are.
That's true. It's a tricky time.
But you're right. That's really important to establish, you know, mm-hmm. your needs, your expectations, your boundaries.
But I do think that kids do have an innate sense of what makes them uncomfortable, though. Mm-hmm. And you can capitalize on that sense, too. Mm-hmm. I remember, just looking back to when I was a kid, there were definitely situations where people were behaving in ways that made me uncomfortable. And I couldn't always say why that was or articulate even to myself why that was. But like looking back on it, it was like, you know, they were behaving in an inappropriate way. I saw these things that were not right. And I did know to respond to that. And I wonder now if part of the reason why I couldn't even articulate that to myself is because we didn't capitalize on this language of boundaries and teaching these things to kids. Maybe I would have had a better sense of it then. So I do agree with you that, yeah, especially having worked in high schools and stuff like that, kids don't always know. But I think they do have a pretty good sense of right and wrong and what makes them uncomfortable. And I think that's a good first step to work with teaching things like this.
It seems like learning to trust your intuition would really help you understand what your needs and your boundaries are. And that's not something that I think young people are taught too much either. And that's what you're talking about, mm-hmm. where it just doesn't feel right. You know, if it's your gut or your heart or your head, you know, whatever it is that is is not feeling right in response to what's being projected towards you, that's your intuition, and it's powerful.
Yeah, totally. Well put.
And I think just to sort of agree with what you're saying, Graham, is that, you know, it is complicated, right? And people, you know, especially, you know, I remember being a teenager, like your feelings are all over the place and your like hormones are raging and you have no idea what's going on, basically. And the fact that we all survived that is amazing. So we are making sure to piggyback the prevention work that we're doing with advocacy work. So we do also have a youth advocate that is specifically available to like deal with some of the complicated issues that teens deal with, and then work through those issues with them so that even, you know, even if they don't feel quite right or they're not quite sure, that we do actually have somebody there that can, you know, can work with them on sort of their particular issues and what, you know, they're actually feeling. Because, you know, we know that everybody's experiences are different and should be treated uniquely. So,
can I segue to a topic that I want to treat carefully? And that is what's been at the top of the social framework lately about where funding goes towards, you know, I don't want to talk about defunding the police, but I want to talk about funding mental health and funding groups like you. And so can we talk about where your money comes from, and is it enough, and is it reliable, and is it coming from the right sources? You're a nonprofit, like we are at the station here. And so we get our money from a lot of different places, including community support. You know, what's the sort of rough breakdown of where your income comes from, and do you have enough resources to operate to what you would think would be your full capacity?
Yes, we can talk about that. We are a nonprofit. We do actually get quite a bit of funding, federal funding from the Violence Against Women Act, and also from the Victims of Crime Act funding. And so that's our pretty stable funding over the years, is that we just continuously get that money from the government. And then we also get sort of mushed together with that is some state funding that comes from sort of the state side that works with domestic violence and sexual assault agencies. So that's a pretty good chunk of what keeps us around from year to year. We also have quite a bit of foundation money coming in at the moment. I think, you know, our prevention program, actually it's not foundation money, sorry, is through a program with the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force called the Rape Prevention Education Grant. So we do, I guess we do have a lot of government money. And then some of the foundations that support us are the Oregon Community Foundation, Meyer Memorial Trust. We get support from the CCO here locally, and some other places. And then we do have funding coming in locally from the community, as well as the county and the cities support the programs that we do.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you have stable, reliable funding.
Yes, I mean, you know, some of it is like we do. It's a, you know, our biggest source is that we do have some, you know, a sort of base of stable funding, and then things seem to be going pretty well. I don't know. We have enough resources at the moment to do what we're doing, but I think that there's always space for more. I mean, you know, we could use more resources. I mean, it's an interesting question, because take housing, for example. This is one of my favorite topics besides prevention and housing, two favorite topics. You know, we actually have quite a bit of funding coming in, and I think this is true in other places, to help people with housing needs. But there is a lack of actual housing available in Clatsop County for people to actually access. So there's a point where, you know, the money just isn't enough, right? It's actually sort of, you know, with either the system or the just the way that things are set up that makes it hard to get people actually what they need. You know, like, we can help people get into an apartment, but are they going to be able to afford to pay rent for the next, like, you know, 2 years? You know, that's the question, because the affordable housing crisis, you know, is so real. And that's, like, such a huge issue that a lot of survivors deal with. And I know a lot of other people also deal with. So, you know, I think we can always use more financial resources, you know, and some of that funding is very specific about what we can use it for. And so that makes it a little harder sometimes too, but then there's
funding,
also just the rest of it too.
That money that's available for you to help with housing, is that so that you can help kind of cover some of those move-in costs, but you can't extend, you know, you can't pay their rent for a year or 2 years or.
Yeah, we would never have that kind of money to support somebody for long-term like that.
It's not intended for, or it's not enough to build a multi-unit, obviously.
No, not at all. Yeah, we could probably help somebody move in. That's about it.
Right.
And I think the other thing that we're seeing is because of the housing crisis, right? We do have an emergency shelter, and it's definitely a resource that's available to people. And this is true actually in other rural communities as well, is that people end up having to stay there longer. You know, it becomes less emergency and more just like there's nowhere for them to go next. And we never want people to end up worse off than they were before. And we don't want people obviously on the street. So.
Yeah, or going back to the situation they came from.
Right.
Well, here's to hoping for more affordable housing in the near future. Then, if you're listening,
this is another good reason
to advocate.
Yeah.
Well, my partner Jess always talks about the Shiloh Inn across the river as a big fat dormitory that's just ready for some population to move in there and take advantage of it. But that's not for me to say. If you're just joining us, Terry and Jordan from The Harbor discussing Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Tell me a little bit about how things have changed at The Harbor since mid-March and the lockdown and the pandemic.
Well, so just to begin with, much like everybody else, we put a bunch of new policies and protocols in place to keep people safe. So we do provide most of our services now over the phone. You know, we had drop-in hours at our advocacy center 5 days a week from 9 to 5, and now we actually only see people in person by appointment only, and that's like in an emergency or if there's like just some great need to see somebody in person, usually in a shelter situation or something like that. But we are able to provide most of our services over the phone, so we can even do a restraining order with somebody over the phone or online. So that was a big change for us, getting everybody functioning that way. But again, if we really need to see people in person, we can do that. And then just the need, you know, the need is greater. And I think we're seeing that across the board, just in general, not even just with survivors of domestic violence or sexual assault, there's just more need, right? You know, like the unemployment rate is higher, like people are, you know, struggling generally speaking. And so then piled that on, you know, on top of, you know, dealing with these traumatic experiences that compounds it. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, our calls have gone up pretty significantly. You know, we're basically doubling our call volume at this point from where we were last year. To give an idea about the emergency shelter, last October, we sheltered 9 people. This October so far, we've sheltered, I think, 25 people in an emergency situation. There's just a lot more going on. And then the other thing that we're seeing is that the experiences that people are having are, they're more violent, they're more devastating, and they're more complicated. And so we do see, you know, people call to find out sort of what their options are. And then, you know, maybe then they call us again and they want to actually do a restraining order against their partner. And then, you know, a month later, they're trying to find somewhere to move to and resettle and like figure out the childcare piece, which is also impossible in Clatsop County right now. And I think it's true in other places. Or trying to figure out how to like maintain their job and all that stuff. So things have just gotten a lot more complicated.
The process of getting a restraining order, you said you can do that over the phone now, right? At what point do your services commingle with the services of the police? Like, is that something that you work with the police on at that point, or does that happen through the county, or?
Yeah, the restraining orders that we work with go through the courts. So we just help people fill them out online. It's like kind of a long process, and then turn them into the courthouse, and then we're available for hearings to support folks if they need it.
And are restraining orders generally pretty effective? Do you see success with that, or is that just one tool in the kit that helps you move on, or?
Yeah, it's a tool, because sometimes restraining orders are not a good idea, actually. They can actually make somebody, if you are used to having all of the power in a relationship and then suddenly somebody takes a restraining order out on you, that could actually escalate your violence, right? So it's not necessarily always a good idea, but it is, it is helpful sometimes. So it just depends on the situation.
Round number, how many restraining orders do you see happen in the course of a year? Is it a few, or is it a hundred, or?
It's a lot.
Is it?
I don't. Wow. I would have to get back to you on that. I don't know the actual number, but
That's
we definitely do a couple every week, at least. So,
Well, I was wondering
if
it would be okay if I just ran a couple of the spots that we recorded with you last year, in coordination with Domestic Violence Awareness Month. I was just going to run two of them, the first one and then the second one, because Jordan had mentioned consent. Can we take a quick listen to those and then come back to the conversation?
Sounds great.
Absolutely.
So this was day one of 16 days of activism against gender-based violence produced by The Harbor in collaboration with KMUN.
Hi, this is Terry from The Harbor, and today is the International Day Against Violence Against Women. It's also the start of the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence, a global campaign launched in 1991 by the Center for Women's Global Leadership that now comprises over 6,000 organizations in over 187 countries whose collective advocacy has reached 300 million people to date. Here in Astoria, at The Harbor, we work with survivors of sexual and domestic violence in Clatsop County every day, and we feel that education and information is key to ending gender-based violence, which can happen to anyone. The Harbor is Clatsop County's community-based advocacy center for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. These issues hurt more than just survivors. They affect our entire community. People you know, your friends, neighbors, and loved ones. The lasting effects of trauma creates long-term mental and physical health problems on survivors and their children. The goal of the 16 Days of Activism is to raise awareness about the far-reaching consequences of gender-based violence, galvanizing government, community, corporate, and philanthropic sectors to dialogue and develop strategies to eliminate gender-based violence. We'll be stopping by KMUN every day for the next 16 days to share some information on what we do and on what you can do to help. If you'd like to learn more, our website is harbornw.org. Or you can check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/harbornw. If you need help or just need someone to talk to, we're also available by phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 503-325-5735.
So all 16 days of activism against gender-based violence are available on our podcast page under Community Partnerships. And here's day two on consent.
Hi, this is Melissa from The Harbor, and today is the second day of the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence. Today's topic is consent and how it relates to the serious problem of sexual assault. This topic can bring up many emotions, especially for those who know someone or who may have experienced sexual assault or abuse themselves. Consent is voluntary, sober, enthusiastic, verbal, active, and honest. Consent is more than not hearing the word no. If your partner is silent or hesitant, they're not giving their consent. If someone says, I guess, if you want to, I don't want to disappoint you, they're not giving their consent. Consent needs to be given enthusiastically. Consent should be given freely. Someone cannot give consent if they feel pressured, threatened, guilted, or coerced into saying yes. Don't assume that your partner is okay with what you want to do. Always ask them and be direct. If you are unsure whether you have someone's consent, make sure to ask again. Someone can give their consent initially and can withdraw their consent at any time. A person who is intoxicated or impaired cannot give consent. Consent applies to a specific act at a specific time only. Be sure to ask for consent for every act, every time. Consent and open communication are keys to healthy, positive sexual experiences and make them more enjoyable for everyone. Here are some ways you can ask for consent. Should I slow down? Does this feel good? Do you want to keep going? Do you like this? Remember, if someone responds by saying, maybe, I don't know, or not right now, you do not have consent. If you'd like to learn more, our website is www.harbornw.org. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/harbornw. And if you need help, we are available by phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 503-325-5735.
So you can hear about the other 14 days on our website under podcasts and community partnerships. And those would include myths about sexual assault, what friends and family can do, victim blaming, why survivors stay in abusive relationships, and more. So that's all on our website, coastradio.org, podcasts, community partnerships. Back to Terry and Jordan from the Harbor. As we finish up the hour here on the conversation, I've heard about the Delta program and some of the DEI work you're doing, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Would you like to share some info about that?
Yeah. So the DEI work has been a huge priority of ours at the Harbor. I think in a community of this size, a lot of times, we just find ourselves in overwhelmingly white spaces. And so we're just really trying to broaden our horizons with DEI. And simultaneously, I was fortunate enough to be nominated to attend the Delta program, the Developing Equity Leadership Through Training and Action program, by Marsha Pack of the college. This is kind of something that I have been fortunate enough to do independent, but also with the Harbor too, because it serves our greater goal. Essentially, it's been an equity leadership training program for different healthcare professionals around the state of Oregon. And I just have to give a lot of shout outs right now, actually. Columbia Pacific CCO was looking for someone from Clatsop County to attend. And I was fortunate once enough again for Marsha Pack to think of me. And then I was sponsored by Clatsop County's CHART organization. There's a lot of acronyms going on here, but the Community Health Advocacy and Resource Team. A team of a bunch of different health organizations here. And essentially, I've been going to these incredible equity training programs with a bunch of healthcare professionals from all over the state. And essentially, I'll be using my teaching degree to spread this knowledge to different health organizations here in Clatsop County. And so I'm also using that knowledge and that leadership training to improve our own DEI committee here at the Harbor too, which has been an ongoing project of ours.
Well, that's great. Is that going to be part of your outreach to the young folks too? You're going to incorporate that, I'm sure, into...
It would be fantastic too. Yeah, I would really, really love that opportunity to do that. As well as just to reach out to different communities around Clatsop County too. We have a huge Latinx community here that we're always just trying to find ways to serve better. We are bringing on two bilingual advocates right now, but I think there is a big cultural issue of segregation between these two communities in our county. I think the pandemic's showing that just as well as anything. So we're really just trying to find ways to reach out to different communities around here. And our DEI work is a huge part of that.
Yeah, that's a very invisible community. And especially once ICE really got ramped up and some mm-hmm. of those raids started happening, I'm sure that folks found it even harder and harder to reach out for help.
If you don't mind me just piggybacking on that comment, that is an issue that we have run in with Latinx clients is sometimes they're afraid that maybe we as an organization will be in contact with immigration services. And once again, this is just a time to say that our confidentiality privileges forbid us from doing that. So if anyone is listening and fearing that situation at all, just know that we don't work with immigration services if we have a survivor who is in need. Their information and their immigration status is confidential.
That's excellent to hear. Well, I think it's time to kind of wrap things up. Do you want to share the hotline again? And you mentioned bilingual as well. Same phone number. And there's just they'll get you in touch with the right person if you need someone in a Spanish-speaking language.
We can call, you can't call the same phone number, but we have a Spanish speaking number too. But before I give the crisis line, can I just say one thing?
Please.
I just want to say that the advocates, like I mentioned earlier, we have been really busy and sort of overstretched and like way busier than we've ever been before. And the advocates have just done such amazing work, and are really just, you know, sticking by people and providing such amazing, you know, support for our survivors. And so I just want to say that, you know, if you see an advocate in the street, you should give them a hug from far away yeah. or a high five or something, because it's just amazing to see them every day just keep trucking forward and providing such great services, and because there is such a great need. And I know it's been hard for folks. So I just wanted to shout out to them.
I'm glad you did. It's truly heroic work. And I think that the confidentiality piece of it probably makes recognition and appreciation a little bit harder to come by for those folks.
Yep. True. Yeah. So they're great. So give us a call. Our crisis line number is 503-325-5735. And again, that's a 24-hour crisis line. So, you know, even in the middle of the night, we're available. We also have a toll-free number, which is 1-877-770-5735. And then for folks who are Spanish-speaking, you can actually reach somebody who speaks Spanish, a translator first, who will then call us. And that number is 1-855-938-0584.
Great. Well, Terry Steenbergen and Jordan, how do you say your last name again?
Okoneski.
Okoneski. I was close. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us and helping the community know more about the important work that you're doing. And obviously the website's a great place to get more information, harbornw.org, right?
Yep.
And you know the phone numbers. So Terry and Jordan, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Graham.
Thanks for having us, Graham.
Yeah, thanks for doing the work you're doing. And we'll talk to you again.
All right.
Great.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, thanks everyone for tuning into the conversation today. Stay tuned. We've got Wednesday morning folk right after headline news. Then the usual deal here on KMUN, fresh air at noon. Lots of great music, news, local public affairs coming at you. I'd like to mention to the members of the station, those who have supported us during our fall pledge drive, I'd like to say thank you so much. You helped us hit our goal, which is really quite astounding. And I have heard from other community radio stations like ours around the country that support for community radio has been stronger now than in any time in recent memory. And that just goes to show that you appreciate us. We appreciate you. This is something that we love providing. And it's just great to know that the community appreciates it and is willing to step up and become members and support this service. So thank you. And if you are now a member of the station, I'd like to invite you to our annual member meeting, which is Saturday, November 7th. It's at 11 a.m. and it is on Zoom. You should have gotten an invitation in the mail along with your ballot to vote for KMUN's board of directors. We've got four excellent candidates for four positions, and so I've got a good feeling about all four of our candidates and their chances of winning the seat on the board of directors. But again, that annual member meeting is November 7th at 11 a.m. on Zoom. If you're not a member, but you want to kind of hear what's going on, we do programmer awards and a director's award and kind of a station update. Then tune in to KMUN 91.9 FM Astoria, 89.5 FM Tillamook, and we will broadcast our member meeting on the air. That's from 11 to noon. Saturday, November 7th. Thanks again for listening to The Conversation. My name's Graham, and stay tuned.